Good evening. You are listening to the Yema
Hey, y'all podcast.
Yema. You are listening to the Yena podcast. We're recording a day early. Today is Tuesday, the 19th of March. As you've heard, we've got Bronwyn, Kia ora,
Kia ora.
and Mark.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. Are you asking about my health?
You really want to talk about
Can
your
do.
health. You really want to talk about your health. So indulge us, Craig. Tell us the amazing adventures of your spine.
Yes, well, I believe last time we podcasted, I was about to go see a specialist. I have since been to see a specialist who looked at me, my MRI, and told me that I have a prolapsed disc in my spine at the L5S1 thingy, whatever it is.
Sounds like an acupuncture point, not a disc. The hell you on about?
Yeah. So anyway, this is the he's showing me the picture of the thing that's pressing against the nerves that's causing me pain in my bum and numbness down my leg, and basically the ideal thing will be to have a microdiscectomy, which they're going to do some surgery on my back and chop out the something that's pressing against the nerves, which should restore things for me, should restore the feeling in my leg properly, and stop me from having pain in my bum and so on, and make it all better. So that will be nice. I don't know what the timing of that is. We have to ask ACC whether they're going to fund it, and if not, then we can go to my private insurance and say, well, you have to fund it instead.
Oh, so this might be one of those near magical cures where suddenly the pain goes away, a bit like Lindley Hood was telling us with her eyesight, where due to medical science, she saw like a night and day difference almost with her eyesight.
Well, I thought you were meeting. Is it just going to suddenly come better by itself? And that seems
No,
unlikely.
but with an operation, are they, I mean, given they know exactly what it is an operation going to be enough that they can, just fix it and it's all good? Or is this potentially going to be a series of operations over a
Oh
period of
no,
months?
it'll be a single operation, as far as I understand. But there is a 2 week recovery period before you're allowed to do anything substantial, and then probably 4 to 6 weeks after that before you're back to normal. So it's not a like go in, they do a little operation, and then you're magically back to normal and running around the neighborhood and whatever. So yeah, but the interesting thing was when the specialist looked at the results of my MRI, he told me that I had these blood vessels around my spine, which are the largest he'd ever seen. And so he talked to another specialist to see whether I should actually get something, get another MRI to figure out to see whether there was anything weird happening there and so on. So my daughter commented, well, they could be looking for an aortic aneurysm. I said, I hope not.
Okay, so presumably enlarged whatever their blood vessels, that's not necessarily a good thing. It might be a sign of something unhealthy down there.
Well, who knows? Who knows? But anyway, so yes, I'm going in to have this MRI next week, which they're going to examine my pelvic area. And I'm just of the opinion that I've got a virile blood supply to my pelvis.
Okie
Well,
dokie. That sounds like there's
so
very much a subtext to that.
yeah.
Reason why you might need a lot of blood supply down there.
Well, who knows? Susan's of the opinion that I drank too much Diet Coke before I went to the MRI.
Damn that Diet Coke. I drink Diet Coke as well. Don't tell me this.
Well, I know, but like you have to be not drinking anything for like 2 hours before the thing. So I sort of went right up to the edge of that 2 hours. Anyway, we shall see when I get the results back of my MRI and see whether there is anything weird going on. But yes, apart from the pain in my bum and leg and tingly toes, I feel perfectly fine. If that's any indication.
Oh, that's good news.
Yes. But unsure of what the timing would be of this operation, especially since I'm starting a new job in 2 weeks, so I won't have any sick leave for 6 months.
Oh, yeah, okay. So you might just have unpaid leave then.
Yeah, depends upon the timing of it. And there are other people in the family who are having operations this year, so.
Oh, sounds a bit busy.
And how's your health been, Mark? Should we make this whole podcast
Yeah, my health has been all right, apart from the I had a weird headache on the Sunday evening. So if anybody wants to know about my health as well, that was a weird one. But we can get onto that later when we talk about my my piece, because it actually ended up becoming, I guess, a favorable, a useful part of my thing that I ended up getting like 16 hours of sleep. So I was well rested at the end of the experiment that I performed.
Maybe these things are connected.
Maybe. But yeah, I also had last week Mormon missionaries visit me. Surprise, surprise. It's becoming a, I'm like a regular attraction for them. Just part of the circuit. Really nice to have them round. One from Samoa and one from Arkansas. We had a nice conversation for an hour or so, and then I had to disappear, so they had to go. But they did ask, "Oh, can we come back?" And it's like, "Of course you can come back. I'd love to have you whenever you want to come round." But it was a great conversation. The one that really challenged them, and I had quite a bit of backtracking and umming and ahhing from one of the two, was that whole thing about how the religion of your parents is the by far the most predictable indicator of the religion that you will end up choosing. That, you know, you might think you've got free choice, but most of the time you just end up reverting to what you're brought up in, what you're used to, what's part of, I guess, your base worldview. And yeah, one of the two really was struggling with this and trying to insist that no, it was her own choice. And yeah, I think it took her a while to digest that. But yeah, they were really friendly, really happy. And as I've written in the editorial of the newsletter, one interesting thing they mentioned that I hadn't heard before was they are doing social media outreach as part of their missionary work now. And I wasn't sure what this meant. I wasn't sure, you know, how they were using social media. But it was actually, I think, only a couple of days later that Dan Ryan from the committee posted to our committee chat that he'd been just randomly messaged by a missionary brother, who said to him, "Sup, bro? I know this is a bit random, but would you be keen on going to church this Sunday?" So I think that's their social media outreach, is they're basically spamming people on social media and just hoping that someone is going to say yes to a church invite.
I wonder how they'd feel if they knew that they were using the same tactic as Eastern Lightning, and everyone's kind of burnt out by that approach.
Well, maybe they know. Maybe they read the articles about how well it's worked for Eastern Lightning, and they're like, "Oh, we should try that as well."
But I think, Merrick, I sort of asked you when this first happened. What kind of which missionaries are being chosen for this social media outreach? Is it everybody, like all the young people, or is it really the ones who can't leave their home country to because they need to support their family? You know, because
Well,
there
so
probably
these, as I
wasn't.
said, were these were both from overseas, but
Oh yeah.
while they're in New Zealand, they're being asked to do it. So I think it's just
Oh.
all missionaries. I think if you're at home, I don't know whether they're getting the people that can't do a mission, or maybe people. So, you know, there's failing your mission. You can go on a mission and not manage the 18 months or 2 years, depending on whether you're a man or a woman. So there are people that go home early. That might be a nice punishment for them to be stuck on social media outreach. I don't know. But it sounds like the ones that are currently on their mission, it is part of their job to do it. But yeah, first time I've heard of it. So it's fascinating that, you know, within a couple of days of hearing about it, suddenly one of our committee members gets spammed by it. Quite a kind of a nice coincidence to see it happening in practice.
Is sup bro really a modern greeting? Not that sort of went out of fashion about 10 years ago.
Unless they think Dan is either they're pointing to Dan as either, you know, a hip young person, you know, hello fellow kids, or they're pointing him out as the millennial and.
Well, it's a missionary, and I think the Mormon missionaries are normally, I think, very late teens or early 20s. I think normally early 20s. So you know, this guy will be young. So maybe he has got a dictionary. Maybe he looked up Dan's age and tried to find age appropriate greetings for Dan. That might be what's going on. Or maybe it's cool and we don't realize. I mean, I keep seeing people dressed like they're from the 80s and they're only in their 20s. It's like, you never lived through the 80s. It was an awful time. Don't go glamorizing it and acting like it was a nice time of life. It was not. It was ugly fashion, awful music.
Everyone dressed like they were a secretary.
Awful music. What?
I was alive in the 80s too, Craig. It was not good music.
I mean, but granted, Mark, we do know what your taste in music is like, and you would probably think playing a sword like a saw like a violin is a bit too mainstream.
Hey, one of our committee members does that. Sarah plays the saw. She has like an acoustic saw and an electric saw, and she used to be a part of a sawcastra when she was in London. So it's done, and it's good music. I've heard her play live, and it's really enjoyable.
Watch out, Sarah. We'll be inviting you to be our entertainment for the upcoming conference.
It could be interesting. So I understand, Roman, that you've been in correspondence with a journalist.
Yeah, we kind of got this random request late last week from a editor of the Kati Kati Advertiser wanting us to comment on this psychic who's been running a cafe, it looks like, for quite a while in sort of the Tauranga area, you know, charging $10, getting 5 or 7 readers and healers in there, doing tarot card readings, and yeah, about $1 a minute. It's kind of an interesting thing. And looking at who this person is, yeah, she's been doing it for a couple of years. What was kind of left out of any articles about her is that she, this person, Fiona Hewitt, is actually part of the Spiritualist Church. So for people who don't know what a Spiritualist Church is, it's been a long standing spiritual practice in New Zealand since, God, maybe certainly from the 1900s. And, you know, their shtick, and it is a shtick, is to do readings, like, you know, have people pretend that they're mediums, so pretend that they're contacting the dead. Last year, Mark, myself, and a few of our other people, it was Alexander and Tim, you know, our local skeptics, joined us at a spiritual church in Upper Hutt, didn't they, Mark?
Yeah, along with my daughter, and we had two, were they twins or just brothers?
I think they're brothers.
Two psychic siblings who I think used to be farmers and realized there was more money to be made giving psychic readings. So they've become, I guess, well-known, at least within spiritualist church circles. And they were an interesting tag team giving readings to people. I didn't get a reading. Did you get one, Bronwyn?
No, I didn't get one. I think we were kind of picked out as being very out of there. We weren't the regulars, maybe. You know, because the thing is, there's this within this whole spiritualist church, it's like a circuit, and they'll have, you know, a rotating rota of local and national mediums and psychics who will come in, and, you know, they'll go to different churches every weekend or so or throughout the week and do their act. So, you know, I'd say probably some of these performers really would already have sort of, I guess, maybe their quote unquote marks, or, you know, quote unquote people that they kind of knew from other readings who would be amenable to the suggestions that they were making.
Yeah. And I mean, when it comes to this cafe, you know, the article that we were able to get to, it was just so credulous, so accepting of all the claims that were being made. It was such a whitewash, you know, making it sound like this was an altruistic thing, like, wow, only $10 you can get your psychic readings, and isn't it an amazing service to the community?
But she can do both. She's both a medium, which is someone who speaks to the dead, and she's a psychic, who's someone who can read people.
Yeah. But the idea that this is altruistic is like, it's so far from the truth. What we know about psychics is that quite often they're very good at drumming up business and making sure that they have repeat business. And presumably this is going to work the same way as the psychic fairs and other things that happen, where what you're doing is like, they don't even do it for free. It's not even a lost leader where you can get a free reading. You're still paying, you just pay less. And there's often a lot of loyalty with a psychic that once somebody gets a, what they think is a good reading, or they have this rapport with the psychic, these people will be repeat customers who might go back once a month looking for relationship advice or career advice. And at the full price for a psychic is it's painful. You know, it, like for an unknown psychic, it can be anywhere between, I'd say, $50 and $100 an hour. For the famous psychics, you're talking $200 an hour plus. I mean, this is expensive stuff just for someone who's basically reading your body language and asking leading questions and other tricks in order to make you feel like they're in touch with you and they understand you. I mean, it's a horrific practice, but it's, like, over time, it's going to cost people a lot of money. So this is not altruistic. This is not them doing something for the benefit of the community. This is people drumming up business so that they have a viable way of making money going into the future. And I can't help but see it as just that and nothing better.
I looked up the population of Cuddy Cuddy, and it's only 5,800 people. So
yeah, so very easy. So very easy to do, get for people to get what's called a hot reading. So, you know, if you know the people who are going to be amenable, or maybe the people, you know, the people who are always coming to the spiritualist church, of course, they're sort of going to be your easy, your first customers to a psychic cafe. And so, yeah, you know, these psychics are probably already sort of, you know, going through their mental index.
For me, as a kid coming from a place of 2,000 people where I used to live, I probably know a bit of gossip about half or more of those, you know, something that would feel like insider knowledge. The person who it was about wouldn't know that the entire island I lived on knew it. But I guess a psychic could use that, possibly even deliberately getting into gossip circles to find out more, and might end up pretty easily looking like they have a connection to the other side, where in actual fact, they just know all the old grandmas in the place and take them out for coffee occasionally.
Did people gossip about you and Mark when you were young?
I presume they do. And honestly, like, after I left the islands that I come from, every time I went back, especially when I went back and got horribly drunk and did daft stuff, I'd be very worried about, oh, what's the gossip mill saying about me now? It was a constant concern. It's kind of a little bit freaky to be living somewhere like that.
But one of the things I was sort of thinking about when I was writing my response to Rebecca is actually, you know, one of our mandates within the New Zealand Skeptics is about education. And I thought it'd probably be a little bit useful, whether it ends up in the eventual response article or what have you. We'll see. It took about maybe almost a month before Andre Chumko wrote, actually ended up publishing the tarot card article that we did last year. There was a bit of a long lead in for that. But going back to this article for Kathy Kathy, you know, probably a little bit more insidious than the hot reading is the skills that people use for cold reading, and just how much information people are willing to give in the course of a friendly conversation that they don't realize is actually quite revelatory. You know, on one hand, it's like the stuff like your body language, you know, what your clothes or what your jewelry can sort of convey about about who you are. But also just asking, you know, people can just ask sort of a bunch of questions like, you know, oh, I see, I'm speaking to somebody whose name begins with the letter N. You know, how many people with the letter M do we know? Like, we have one in this podcast already. Everyone in New Zealand knows Mark Honeychurch. But you know what, Mark? You know what Matthew
does anyway.
But you know what, Mark? You know Matthew? You know Michael? These, like, I think it's Michael's one has for a long time been one of the top boys' names in like for boomers. You know, so okay. Everyone probably knows a dead man whose name begins with M.
I did when we sent the response to the journalist, we all as a committee generally get a chance to edit these documents. I did remove Boomer from your response. I don't know whether you noticed that, but
not really, no.
But yeah, I think you came up with some really good examples of things like Barnum statements. You know, one you had in there was you often have doubts about whether you've made the right decision. And then the one about sometimes you can be very happy, but other times you have a low mood. And these things that fit with everybody. And at some point, you know, in our lives, it will gel with us. And these are things that we all go through. But most of the time we think, oh, are we the only one that goes through this? But they're just part of the human condition. Another one I like that isn't quite a Barnum statement, but I saw Derren Brown use it years ago, was he had this great question when he was pretending to be a psychic. He was doing a reading for someone's dead father. And the question was, your dad didn't like boats, did he? And this was great because if you say yes, it was like, I thought I was getting a picture of a boat. And if you say no, the answer is, yeah, no, I thought he didn't like them. I can really get this feeling that he wasn't a big fan of boats. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question that's worded, he didn't like boats, did he? Whatever the answer is, you can make it fit. And that kind of thing is genius. And I think sometimes psychics might not even realize they're using these things. They learn them.
It's a trick called the vanishing negative.
Right. Okay. There's a name to it. Cool.
Yep. Yeah. It was in my letter.
I didn't even see that mentioned.
Yeah. But yeah. So it's, I think it's really important that, you know, as skeptics, you know, on one hand, I think potentially I may have misunderstood this video by Mark Edwards, but, you know, you don't want to, you know, encourage or inoculate, you know, your scammers to be able to bypass the, you know, that we know that these cold reading tricks exist. But at the same time, you know, our lay person does need to know these very simple, you know, these are very simple tricks, because it's very normal for us to have this confirmation bias. We want to believe in things. We want to believe in things that reflect positively onto us.
Yeah. I think psychics are mainly going to be too lazy to move off of using these simple tricks. I mean, anything harder than a simple trick, most people aren't going to be able to manage it. And again, lack of education, a lack of understanding of how psychics do these things, most people will not be aware of Barnum statements and these other really simple ways in which you can kind of make that connection with them. So yeah, I can't help but think that it's fine. We really should educate people, and we should let everybody know what's going on.
Mm. Of course, people who are going along to psychics are often in a vulnerable emotional state, and so they're not going to be sitting there with their psychic bingo card crossing off each of the...
Yeah. So, and often they can be true believers as well, especially when they do find the psychic that gels with them and they become a regular. Like, they can hear or see, you know, thorough debunkings, and even then they'll come out with some excuse in their head as to why, well, maybe the psychic was having an off day, you know, they've been fine with me, but maybe they were just under the weather, maybe they had COVID or something. You know, people can very easily make excuses for why they happen to look a lot like a con artist.
And I think that's why it's important that, you know, we should always be constantly like referring people to projects and big projects that have been done. So I think it was Richard Saunders with the Australian Skeptics. For about 21 years, they were doing that research and, you know, sort of comparing all the claims that various psychics made, and found that, you know, really nothing that, you know, what's happened, they didn't predict. And a lot of what they predicted didn't happen.
Really, it was kind of no better than chance and worse than people making educated guesses. Mm. Making educated guesses was a better way of predicting the future if you just had a little bit of an idea about geopolitics. And the other one, I guess, is Susan Gerbic. And for anybody that doesn't know, as well as doing guerrilla skepticism on Wikipedia, Susan Gerbic does some really interesting psychic stings where she out and out shows psychics, especially that are hot reading. She gets people to make fake Facebook profiles, and then you know, lots of information that basically is just totally made up, and this is information that then comes out in a psychic reading showing that the psychic has read the Facebook page. And she does a good job of doing that, but again, no matter how many times she shows that psychics are faking it, people still seem to think, well, maybe my psychic is true, maybe they're real and they're not faking it just because others are faking it.
I'm also reading this really interesting book. I always buy books and I read them maybe like around Christmas time, and I read them maybe 1 or 2 years later. So I have a collection of unread books like anyone else. But I'm finally getting
a cold reading statement?
Yeah, probably.
anybody.
And is it actually cold reading if you only read the book after a couple of years?
Best served cold. But this one's by Gary Nunn. He is a UK born, but he sort of splits his time between Sydney. He's like a Australian reporter, and he's written this book called The Psychic Tests. And, you know, he's doing interviews with all these different people about their experience with psychics. I think there's a little chapter with Richard Saunders in it. And, you know, he's also, I think, kind of part of what kicked it off was his sister, you know, starting to get in touch with psychics after their father died. But also, I think it was a few years ago, a major stock brokerage firm kind of went bankrupt because one of their head CEOs was contacting a psychic, and, you know, had the psychic on their payroll and letting the psychic sort of help them determine what investments and what decisions they were making. So, you know, it's anybody, you know, the people that we think are, you know, should know better, you know, money and should protect them. They would have actual advisors. Everyone's vulnerable to the ploys of a, whether they're well-meaning or, you know, ill-intentioned.
And as we said, especially when emotions are involved, it's hard to remain skeptical and remain dispassionate. I had a friend call me up a couple of years ago. He's a good skeptical guy, not a member of the skeptics, but he, you know, he thinks skeptically, he's rational. And he phoned up with a really interesting question, which was basically, my dad died last year. Since then, my mum's been to see a psychic a couple of times. It seems eerily accurate. Are you sure psychics aren't real? It was like, all right, let's just talk through how the psychic readings went, you know, what you've heard secondhand, and let's hear what the evidence is, and let's try to think of other alternative explanations. And some of it I couldn't have an explanation for, except for this is secondhand or thirdhand by now. Like, maybe what actually happened doesn't match what you're saying happened, but some of it definitely sounded like a mixture of cold reading and sadly hot reading, which, you know, is always disappointing when these psychics aren't just fooling themselves. They are deliberately going out and looking up people's information in advance. That there's a definite malice of forethought to that, which I find a lot more creepy.
Mm-hmm. Thomas John.
Yeah, so Susan Gerbic has recently written an article about Thomas John and his history as a scammer. Like, he used to rent out apartments that didn't exist to people and take their money, and now he's doing the same where he's offering psychic readings to people in the US, taking their money and then just not turning up for the psychic reading online, and then basically totally ghosting them, if that's not too much of a psychic pun, refusing to answer calls, having taken hundreds of dollars.
I would say that's not enough of a pun there, Mark. That's not there's a threshold that's there's a threshold that that's not meeting yet.
All right. That's good then. If it's not a pun, I'm happy and I don't feel guilty.
Okay. Well, I was trying to think of a segue, but I've not been able to ride on one lately.
Oh, this was painful. I can't believe that this is a thing. Can you please walk us through the segue thing? Because I just can't even.
Well, something popped up in the Skeptics chat saying, pointing to an article online that was saying that is it now acceptable to spell segue as in the sort of change of one conversation to another, spelled S-E-G-U-E, as segue as in the portable personal transport device thing that you walk on, that you ride on, that's spelled S-E-G-W-A-Y.
Yeah, and the answer to is it acceptable to misspell that word? No, it's not acceptable. It absolutely isn't.
Exactly. Many of us grammar Nazis and pedants objected firmly to this being the case.
It's like, I think the committee was pretty much unanimous, right?
It's like when something piques your interest.
When it's P-E-A-K or P-E-E-K. Yeah.
Maybe we should have a spin-off podcast, the Grammar Nazi podcast. It probably already exists.
And Nazi's probably not a term we can use anymore. We've got to come up with some other evil group.
Yes. Anyway, speaking of evil, so upon yours, Mark, and Bronwyn's urging, I went along to Rationalist House this week to a meeting about effective altruism, or EA as it's known.
And was it rational? In Rationalist House, you'd expect it to be fully rational, right?
Well, you would have hoped so. It was a bit different from what I expected it to be. What it actually turned out to be was essentially a meeting of the EA club from the University of Auckland, and they were using Rationalist House as the venue for their meeting. So there were a few young people there who I assume were students, and there were a few older people as well. There was a couple of faces that I recognised, having been to a few events at Rationalist House before. But yeah, so I'd sort of sat down to have a listen to what they were going on about, and I kind of expected it to be a presentation on effective altruism and how it worked and how great it was and so on. It didn't actually turn out to be that. But essentially, what is effective altruism? Well, according to their website, which is a worldwide organization, they say they like to be doing good better.
I mean, I think a lot of us saw, you know, a lot of us who may have been skeptics for maybe over a decade, probably saw a lot of Catherine Lowe's presentation. What was it, 2014, that she was kind of doing a lot of the big rounds to Sunday Assembly?
She did a presentation at the 2016 Skeptics Conference, which was in Queenstown. And of course, whenever we have Susan Gerbic mentioned number two in the podcast along to one of our conferences, she always does a great write-up. And so you can actually look up her write-up of the 2016 New Zealand Skeptics Conference in the Skeptical Inquirer. It's available online. And she was talking about how Catherine Lowe did a great presentation about effective altruism. And at those sorts of presentations, the main idea was about making sure that the money that you are giving to good causes or charities is actually effectively spent, and that it's kind of you're getting the most bang for your buck, that it's actually doing good rather than just providing money for the administrators or the buildings that they house their organizations in, or actually doing things that aren't really effective.
So like it's sort of like, you know, don't, and I was looking at their website, their GiveWell website, and they're still very, very positive about malaria treatment because malaria, you know, malaria treatment, it's very cost effective. Whereas I think in the original, like when it first came out, sort of the original example of a poor idea was something called play pumps. And the idea that, you know, you'd have children play on this particular merry-go-round and pump water, which really did not gel with the local population, how the local population responded to these
Well,
sort of.
it just doesn't work. I mean, the reason it doesn't gel is because a merry-go-round is a freewheeling playground piece of equipment for kids where they jump on it and they push it and then it keeps going round fast for a long time. But as soon as you attach that to a pump that does work pumping water, it stops freewheeling. It stops spinning by itself. You end up basically having to push it constantly in order to make it go around. So it ends up just being a device to pump water. And the whole principle of the idea of the play pumps that kids would love playing on it just goes out the window as soon as you realize that the physics doesn't allow this. It ends up just being you're using slave labor, child slave labor, in order to basically pump the water out of the ground and inefficiently. Apparently, there are much more efficient ways of using human energy to pump water than a merry-go-round playground device. So yeah, the whole thing was horrific from start to end.
So how has it
Anyway.
evolved? How has it evolved since, you know, yeah, like the mid-2010s?
Well, so Mark was writing an article for the NZIRH, and which I sort of cribbed off a little bit from my article. But what it's evolved into is the idea that the core idea of effective altruism is that all lives have value. One of your neighbors or your family, their lives are valuable as much as somebody you've never met in a place you've never been. So the children in Africa have valuable lives as much as the people in our own country. The effective altruism has been hijacked by this idea that by a concept called long-termism, where they are trying to consider that there are many, many more people yet to be born who we should care about versus the people that are currently living. And if we can do something that makes the lives of billions of people yet to be born better, then that is a better investment of our effective altruism dollar. Now, Mark, you're going to no doubt tell me about the stupid maths that underlies this.
Yeah, it's a really interesting. I mean, what they do is they talk about how, you know, maybe there's a chance that we can seed not just our solar system, but other solar systems, that we'll be able to fly out to far-flung planets. So there is like a 0.0001% chance that the population will get up into the trillions, and maybe AI will become dominant and malevolent, and maybe it will enslave us all, and they'll put guesswork percentages to these things, and then they'll multiply them together and they'll say, look, you know, it might be very unlikely to happen, but with the trillions of lives that are involved, isn't it worth considering the chance of this happening? And isn't it worth us trying to stop this from happening in advance? So they've kind of gone for some very big numbers in both directions and said, actually, because even though it's very unlikely to happen, because it would involve trillions of human beings in the future, that still means that it's a worthwhile cause to be trying to make sure that those trillions of humans have a better life. And I mean, the outpouring of it, the result of it, is just a little bit crazy, right?
Yeah, I guess if it's taking money away from tangible and practical good causes here at the moment, I think it's really a bad thing to be concentrating on that. So the EA club at the University of Auckland, they seem to be oriented around doing projects. And what I got from the talk they were doing was sort of about how they did talk about existential risk. They did talk about AI governance. So it seems that those sort of far out ideas that incidentally are very popular amongst the Silicon Valley tech bros, such as Elon Musk, who's trying to seed Mars with a second site of humanity. Those things are sort of being taken aboard by the EA Club at the University of Auckland. And I heard mentioned that they had actually had some people that had been funded to go to overseas conferences to talk about existential risk and AI governance. So it is definitely happening. They also put quite a lot of emphasis on how this EA stuff would be good for your career. So I guess that they're wanting to see projects done that look good on the CV, but equally there's this idea that during a career you typically spend 80,000 hours at work, and there's this organization called 80,000hours.org that has these ideas about how you can best navigate your career in order to gel with these EA ideas, and how what some of the fields that it would be good to go into would be to be most effective in your career. And they have this list of fields and projects where they say, these are the things where having an additional person working on this thing would have the most benefit. And right at the top of that list is AI governance.
Right. So it's all about AI safety and being one of those people that decides how to make AI safe and how to know that an AI is not going to enslave us all. But there's another part of it as well, isn't there? That there's a suggestion that you really need to focus on your career, because the more money you can make, the more money you can then donate to charities once you're stinking filthy rich. And this is something that happened with Sam Bankman-Fried, who started up a crypto exchange and his own cryptocurrency. And he became very rich with other people's money, and he donated millions of dollars of it to Effective Altruism, presumably making him feel like he was doing a good thing. But I think a lot of these donations coming from these rich crypto and tech guys is coming with stipulations that it does need to be spent on AI and on other tech things, rather than on helping underprivileged people in third world countries, which to me, that's the root of AA. That's where it should have, sorry, not AI, EA. That's where it should have been spent.
Electronic artists?
It's where it should still be sent. That's where the project of Effective Altruism was doing most good. And to see so much of their effort being redirected to these far-flung futurist ideas. I mean, I've always had a bee in my bonnet about futurism. You like the idea that you can in any way predictably guess what's coming up in the future. I mean, what we generally see from futurists is that they fail. And the ones that do succeed is probably just the luck of the draw. When you've got thousands of people guessing what the future might hold, one of them is just accidentally going to be right. And I don't think anybody really...
Hang on. Are you talking about futurists or psychics?
Yeah, maybe this fits with both, and that's kind of an interesting parallel, isn't it? But yeah, so I think, you know, the arrogance here of Effective Altruist to basically say we think that we can help people in the far-flung future, and because we think that we can see what the future's probably going to hold, and also we can figure out what steps need to be taken now that we can make the changes we want to see in the future that we're imagining, like, I don't think anybody on Earth is able to do that. I think that's like life is so chaotic. Geopolitics is so confusing and so many people have their fingers in the pies. I just don't think you can do it.
Yeah. I think in general, people get rich by being lucky in a lot of respects. There are, I don't know of anybody who's got rich because they made fantastic predictions about the future.
Yeah, and the lucky ones who do get rich, they then go and write a book about what they did, even though that had nothing to do with them getting rich, it was just the luck, and expect everybody else to follow their advice as if they're some kind of oracle.
Yeah. This idea about how people should go into high-paying careers so that they can donate more of their money to EA. Yes, I'm not so certain about that because, you know, that's what rich people do. They tend to give away all their money to good causes.
I was reading an article about this sort of trend at Harvard University. They've had a club there for about, you know, over a decade. And it's quite interesting about, you know, yes, you can have these, you can talk about these principles of EA, but, you know, they're still spending like thousands of dollars trying to get, you know, a building or to have parties or, you know, workshopping events. All very, you know, and on one hand, all very reasonable things about, you know, having an organization and trying to build skills and capacity. But on the other hand, with a group like EA, you kind of have to be very, very careful about how you
spend
that money.
Well, that's an interesting point. I went and had a look on Facebook for the EA at the University of Auckland, and they do have a Facebook page, but all it is filled with social events. So not wanting to disparage them, but I kind of get the impression that at least part of it is about just having a good time. And there's nothing wrong with that if you're a university student, but yeah.
Yep.
But anyway, so that was the first part of the evening. During that, I think it was attended by probably 15 or 20 people. At the start of the evening, they ran what now seems like just a bit of an icebreaker exercise where we got to talk to different people and say what our values were. I talked to this guy at the start, who I shall mention a little bit later, and said I think I value honesty and not ripping people off. And so we had a little bit of a talk about that. And he related to me that he thought it was a bad idea to give, well, he generally thought it was a bit of a bad idea to give money away to people anyway, but certainly to give money to beggars on the street. And that perhaps is a bit of a debatable point as to whether begging on the street is actually a job and you're actually making good money out of it or whether you're actually doing it to support yourself. But then, afterwards, there was a bit of a social event where we all got to have a few snacks and talk to other people. And I heard this guy talking to a younger Asian student about how he was complaining that the AI is too woke and that it was producing all these results, which in his opinion were woke. Now, there certainly is some truth to this. And in fact, the Google AI was, there was a bit of a controversy around it because it was a multimodal AI where it could produce text and images. And when you asked for things like, show me an image of the founding fathers of the US, then what it was turning back was a whole lot of black people. So there was some consternation.
And I think Asian Nazis was another one that it was producing.
Yeah. Anyway, so I said to this guy, well, what do you mean by woke? And because I said, well, I consider myself woke and I don't consider it to be a bad thing. And so then what sort of came out was a whole bunch of very, very racist stuff, which I won't really repeat, but it was basically about why we have worse outcomes for Maori and Pacific Islanders, and it's essentially because of their culture, and they don't have a culture of wanting to do well in school or wanting to get a job or wanting to eat healthily and so on. So, yeah, no, it was all very, very simplistic stuff, quite nasty, racist stuff. And, yeah, I so I wasn't very pleased about that. But if it be in a conversation with somebody like that, I'd never have all the great arguments that to come back with on the spot. They generally come to me later on. So I don't think I necessarily, well, I very much doubt that he had a changeable mind. But yeah, I mean, I know that there is a lot more depth to these issues than what he was spouting. Yes, I said at the end of my item in the newsletter that it's a shame that sometimes organisations like the rationalists and the sceptics have people in them who think they're thinking uber rationally when in fact what they're doing is they're just having simplistic ideas that they think can solve the world's problems without actually being experts on the topic.
And as a little bit of an aside, as an NZARH council member that I have been for a few years now, I can confirm from what I can tell from having already chatted to you about this guy that he is a known issue with the NZARH. He is a problem that I guess hasn't been fully dealt with. He's obviously still around spouting these views, but he has been upsetting people and putting people's backs up already. It's disappointing to hear him turning up to an event like this and giving his views so forcefully.
And it would be a shame if people were put off going along to these sorts of events because of those sorts of people turning up and having those sorts of views. And indeed, we've had the occasional person at Skeptics in the Pub who spouts similar sorts of views, which isn't particularly pleasant. And sometimes people move away from them down to the other end of the table, and sometimes people sit there and try and argue with them. And
yeah, it's a tough one to deal with because you want to be kind, especially for Kiwis. You know, it's that whole thing of just keeping quiet and being nice, but sometimes you just have to put your foot down and say, no, that's not acceptable here. Because you've got to think about the wider movement, you know, that giving this one person his space to spout his nonsense is something, free speech and all that. But if one person turning up causes eight other people to not turn up anymore, then it's a net loss, and probably better to lose that one than all the potential new people that might turn up once and be scared away.
Feels like the paradox of tolerance, about tolerating the intolerant.
Ah, Karl Popper.
Yes, indeed. Anyway, perhaps we could have run a roller over his head to improve him.
That was an awful segue. Unless the roller is a segue, in which case, I don't know.
I was thinking about that earlier. Your jade rollers bear a striking resemblance to an actual Segway that you stand on.
Did you use actual jade, or is it like a quartz?
Hang on. I'm holding it up for all our listeners to see. Can everybody see this? There we go. Yeah. It does look a little bit like a Segway.
Yeah, I don't think that it's actual real jade or punamu.
I don't know how to tell you the way. It
How
looks
much did
a bit
you pay for it?
Dull. At $9 plus postage.
I think it's real jade.
last year we talked a little bit about, you know, in terms of like witchcraft and people using crystals and putting gemstones and rocks and minerals into the water when they really shouldn't. Gotta ask. I mean, if you
or
don't know, that's
places.
Jade. Yeah, in other places. I mean, is it safe? Are these products actually safe to put on your skin?
I bought this jade roller a couple of months ago. Let's skip back a little bit. A friend messaged me. I don't know why he found this article. It was in Glamour magazine. He's not the type to read Glamour magazine, but somehow he found it, and it had the word skeptic in it. The news article, it's probably just a glorified advert, let's be honest. In its lifetime, I found three different titles. When I was sent it, it was called "I Asked Jade Roller Obsessive to Convince Me That I Need One." But at one point, it had been called "Jade Roller Benefits. We Investigated What Jade Rollers Do." And by the time I reopened the article the other day, it was titled "All the Jade Roller Benefits You've Heard Are True." So became less skeptical over time. But there was a byline to it, which was, "I was a skeptic, now I'm a convert. Here's why." So I'm thinking maybe my friend just saw the word skeptic and went, "Oh, Mark's a skeptic. He'll be interested in this." So he sent it to me, and he then suggested that maybe I should buy one. And as an experiment, maybe I should just roll one side of my face and not the other and see if I can see the difference. Because the claims for these jade rollers, these are little handheld like a handheld wire thing with like a barrel at the end made out of jade or possibly some kind of resin if I've been scammed. And the idea is that you roll it over your body. I think mainly they used for the face, so I went for the face. And the claims seem to be around both the cooling effect helps with circulation, but also that it's doing something with your lymph nodes. Now, this first article from Glamour magazine, they talked to a few experts and a couple of people that just happened to use them. And from the experts, it appeared that the idea of how it worked was both that it drains the fluid out of your lymph nodes and that it pushes fluid into your lymph nodes, and that fluid can then get rid of the toxin. So even the experts, and I'm putting this again visually so our listeners can't see it, but I'm putting this in scare quotes, these experts who also appeared to all be people that sold jade rollers, they couldn't even agree on how this damn thing worked. But I ordered one, and I looked around a little bit. AliExpress, it was going to take too long. It's like a month these days for stuff to appear from AliExpress. Temu, even then, it was going to be a week. I wasn't willing to wait that long. So I ended up, and I just love the irony of this, dicksmith.com. So I ended up ordering. I mean, like, Dick Smith is a well-known Australian skeptic, right? And as I say in the article, I know he sold his name and the entire business like nearly 10 years ago.
Oh, longer than that. It was actually, he actually sold his Dick Smith organization back in the 80s to Woolworths.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because what I read was that Dick Smith was sold to Kogan in 2016, but if he sold it prior to that even then, Woolworths owned it until then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
There were a whole bunch of Dick Smith stores in New Zealand. They went into receivership or something, I think. But then they continued operating in New Zealand as an online only business. And I've ordered stuff off them, and it comes from Australia, and the cost of actually getting it here is quite prohibitive.
Yeah. When I first arrived in the country back in 2005, I'm pretty sure there were still physical Dick Smith shops, but they disappeared not long after that. But yeah, the idea anyway, that this guy is a well-known skeptic. I think he's given good money to the Australian skeptics, supported skeptical causes. And here I am buying a jade roller, like one of the most nonsense things you could think of, from a website with his name on it. The irony was not lost on me, but it turned up in 2 days. So I'm very happy with that, and it didn't cost me that much. And then
it's good that somebody having a medical emergency that needs a jade roller can get it quickly.
Absolutely. And possibly, I think I could have paid for like expedited delivery as well. I might have been able to get it in one day. but so I ended up, when this arrived, it's like, well, now what do I do with it? You know, what is my new beauty regime going to look like? So I had a read of that article, and my friend sent me another article as well on Holland and Barrett, and I read through them, and there was a description of how to do it, but it confused me, so I went on to YouTube, found myself a nice, simple YouTube video with a young, good-looking woman explaining how to do it. She was close. She had a really good routine, but it wasn't logical enough for me. It went up the face from the bottom. So there's two ends to this roller. There's like a big roller end, and then there's like a thinner one. One that's maybe, so the big roller, what do you say that is? Maybe 5 centimeters across, and the small roller maybe 2 centimeters, 3 centimeters across. So her regime was to start at the neck and roll down from your chin 10 times and then across your jaw 10 times. In fact, I can demonstrate for you guys. So I was rolling down.
We should be recording video and have this.
Yeah, 10 times. And then from the middle, I'd go out to one side. So from the middle of my chin, I'd go out across the jaw. And then I'd go across my cheek 10 times. And then I do my forehead from the middle out. And then I'd switch sides.
What's the chance of that thing getting caught in your beard?
It's happened a couple of times, which has been a little bit painful, but it's not too bad. Yeah, and believe it or not, she didn't have a beard, so she wasn't suffering from this problem. So the last bit is that we go 3 with the small end. So it's over the eyelid, under the eye. So I guess getting rid of the bags, which I have quite substantial bags, and then over the top lip, which again is basically over my moustache for me. And so that was the regime. She had it slightly different. She did under the eye and then across the eye, but My regime goes up to the top and back down to the bottom. It makes much more sense for me. But I did this for 2 months, once or twice a day, depending on how often I'd remember. I did this every day for 2 months, but I only did it on one side of my face. So one side of my face should at least look 2 months younger if it just arrested the aging. But from what I read, it's meant to reverse the aging. It's meant to make me look younger. So really, I'm expecting quite a marked difference between the two sides. Now, I don't want to give away for our listeners who might also be readers of the newsletter which side it is, because I've asked people to click on one or other link to our website so I can totally unscientifically find out what people think of my face and which side looks younger. But you two, have a quick look at my face. What do you reckon? Which side do you think is the younger side?
I think you're using lighting tricks which side is younger.
Because your left side definitely looks
well lit.
Younger,
this is dark. Hang on. Let me bring this into the middle.
No.
Do I just look evil now? My goodness. There. Surely that's good lighting. Have you got it?
Now you're on an angle.
Yeah. I was still going to say your left side, but there's not much of it.
So my left is here. This side is younger?
Yes.
Okay. Bronwyn?
Yeah, I agree, I guess.
Okay, you're going.
But I'm wondering if you've if there's a flaw in your experiment. I mean, do you often rub your face or wash your face?
There are 37 different flaws in my experiment. This is far from being something that I would ever trust as evidence. I mean, as I say in my article, it's a single data point. It's anecdote. And even if it was the plural of anecdote, it's not data, as us skeptics say. I'm collecting the results by just looking at Google Analytics for how many people visit a page at skeptics.nz/jade/left or /jade/right. So if a bot finds one of those pages and not the other, and that gets counted in the analytics, then that's going to have more results, not because anybody clicked on anything. Yeah, I mean, who knows? Maybe me draining the lymph nodes on one side actually helps the other side as much or more. Maybe the lymph nodes are connected to the opposite sides of the face. But as far as I can see, like, there's not much difference. And I at least had one control. I took a picture of my face before I started at the beginning of the 2 months. So just in case one side of my face already looked a lot older than the other, people can see that. And so they weren't just comparing one side to the other. They were also looking at how did they compare beforehand and how did they compare after. But yeah, it's unscientific from beginning to end. But as I say in the article, one thing that I actually have found useful, and I think I will continue to find useful, is we know it's not valid to ask someone, yeah, but have you tried it yourself? But most people don't know this. Most people think that that's an okay thing to ask, that one way to know whether something's working is just to test it yourself. We know that, no, science trumps somebody's personal experience. But now if anybody asks me, yeah, but have you tried a jade roller yourself? I can say, yeah, I tried it for 2 months and I couldn't see a damn difference between one side of my face and the other. And most people couldn't tell either. I've had a few people tell me, no, I just can't tell. You two have given me a result. I've got about three other results and I can tell you it's about 50-50 so far. So it's not looking positive for the jade roller.
And when are you going to reveal the actual side that you used it on?
I think the next newsletter, I will put everybody out of their misery and let them know which side is actually much more youthful. Maybe it's, I don't know, beauty is only skin deep, but it's something under the skin. Maybe in 20 years, I'll suddenly start noticing that one side looks younger than the other.
Maybe. Yes. Maybe you can't tell for years that you're making an investment in your future health, Mark.
And then suddenly in 20 years' time, I'm going to look like I've had a stroke because one side's going to be droopy and wrinkly.
You're
and the
going
other
to regret not using it on both sides, aren't you?
Am I now going to have to do 2 months on the other side just to
even it out?
I thought I was done with this. I don't want to do more. It's boring. Like, that's an extra half a minute in front of the mirror every day. Oh, God damn it. Now you're making me think I do actually need to do No, I'm not. Right. I'm no.
I kind of think you actually need to figure out what that roller is made out of, in case you've just actually been putting in some poison into your skin. And then actually, it's not about youthfulness. It's an early death is what we need to think about. Which side is going to die first?
Okay. So it's meant to be some kind of rock gem type thing, right? And geologists normally figure out what something is by licking it. So why don't I just lick it and see what it tastes like?
But it's gonna taste like you. It's gonna taste like your skin.
It's got 2 months of me on it, but maybe it'll taste of something other. I'm not.
You haven't got a Geiger counter, have you?
I think we need to
Sorry?
call a triple one.
You haven't got a Geiger counter, have you? It might be radioactive.
I've just licked it. I hope it's not radioactive. That's not gonna be good. No, it doesn't really taste of anything, but I don't know if Jade tastes of anything, so it could
If
be
only you
Jade.
if only you had the wrapper or the box and would tell you where it was manufactured.
It didn't come in a box. It was shrink wrapped with nothing else other than like a clear, transparent shrink wrap. There's
Oh
no
dear.
instructions with this thing. Yeah, I don't know where it came from, where it's been.
Our condolences to Karen for the premature death of Mark Honeychurch.
It might have been returned from another customer who rolled something unsightly with it. I just don't know.
So what's happening around the country?
A few things. Congratulations to Need and Skeptics. They have three events.
Three events. What are they doing?
Well, it's one per month, so I mean
All
they're not
right.
doing much,
Oh.
but they're doing something.
They're giving you plenty of advance notice.
Exactly. So on April 11th, which is a Thursday at 6 p.m., they are going to be back at Umbrella's Kitchen and Bar. So to Needed Skeptics or Wannabe Skeptics, come join our crew in the South Island. Then we have Skeptics in the Pub in Wellington at our usual hangout, the lobby lounge of the Intercontinental Hotel, which is on 2 Grey Street, not the restaurant. Just go into the hotel and hang a right to the bar. That'll start at 6 p.m. And it's going to be most of our usual crew. It's a great place to get some drinks, get some food, and have some good conversation. I think next Friday at 6 p.m. is also the next Skeptics in Cyberspace. So we
Yes,
will
it
have
is, and
them.
I still need to create an event for that, but I will do that later tonight.
Yeah, that will be starting at 6 p.m. on Zoom. And Mark, do we have our usual science-based something something at the something something place?
We do. I am running the something something next Thursday, the 20-somethingth, at Fork and Brewer from 6 o'clock-ish. Yeah, and we're still working on the plagiarism project. We're getting closer, but the more we look into it, the more we're finding and the more sources we have to download to compare to. It's a behemoth of a project, but we're getting there slowly. So if you want to come and help us out with that boring, thankless task, you are more than welcome to join us in the pub. And honestly, I'll buy you a free pint just for turning up at this point. Come and help us with this horrible, horrible job, and you get a pint.
Somebody who's a listener who I'm close to was wondering how many podcast episodes we're going to mention this plagiarism thing on without actually revealing who it is.
Well, I thought when I first mentioned it that it wasn't going to be long before we could actually reveal it. But the one thing we really want to do is a thorough job. We don't want to say, well, this is just the tip of the iceberg. We don't know how deep it goes. We're never going to be exhaustive. We're never going to manage to find everything, but we want to give it a good old college try. We want to just try and be as thorough as we can be within our means. Like we're trying to download scientific papers at the moment, and we can't get hold of all of them. Some of them, the names don't seem to match any known scientific paper. Some of them we just can't find on the usual places, Sci-Hub, that you find scientific papers if you need to get hold of them. So we can't get everything, but we really are trying our hardest to get as many original sources as possible to compare with. So yeah, it's taking time. I apologize for all you that feel like I'm just dangling this carrot in front of you, this juicy story that never eventuates. And it might never eventuate. Who knows? If we talk to a lawyer and they say, no, you can't do anything with this, that's too scary, maybe it'll never see the light of day. But I think it should do, and I think we'll probably be fine. So maybe another few weeks and we're all good.
We'll just keep watching the space.
But it's all important. What's really important is that you as skeptics actually make the event. So start doing skeptical things and we can put it into our calendar, which is still missing maybe about 30 dates. Make the skeptical news yourself.
Speaking of skeptical dates, so Auckland is having its next Skeptics in the Pub on Tuesday, the 2nd of April. And I believe this one will be at the Brew on Quay. So that is the 2nd of April, which is the Tuesday after Easter.
Nice. And being a Tuesday and not a goodness knows what other day, you'll actually be able to buy a pint without needing to buy any food.
Sure, yes. If we had had it on Easter itself, we would have been subject to those ridiculous religious-based laws in New Zealand.
Totally need to go sooner rather than later.
All right. You have been listening to the ENR podcast. If you'd like to give us some feedback, you can send us an email to podcast@skeptics.nz. I got it right this time.
Well done, you.
And yes, we will see you all next time. Goodbye.
Kakite.
See ya.